Want to start with a few preliminary remarks about how this is going to run. I start with a vision to do the entire Bible, a survey through the entire Bible last year, and I'm trying to target and use wisely the breakdown of the year as we do it here, which is different, again, blame me for this, but it's different than quarters, which is what your normal Christian ed pattern goes. January through May is 5 months, June through August is 3 months, and September through December is 4 months, and that way we can give longer periods of time to more in-depth studies of Christian ed than just a 13-week regular pattern. And I've used that myself several times and found it beneficial. So I started with the wisdom literature, you remember, last year. I think that was the 4 months. And we walked through the Psalms and the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and all of the wisdom literature aspect of the Old Testament. And now I wanted to offer a survey through the New Testament and pick the 5 month period of time to do that because it's sizable, it's very important, and probably wanted to be more meticulous or more in depth than I had been for the wisdom literature. But as I was preparing the class, and I'm about halfway through my preparations on it, it dawned on me that I'm not going to get done in time. So I'll probably change the title of this to just Acts and Paul, or just the history and the writings of the New Testament, and come back later perhaps with more in-depth examination of the Gospels. So that's, if it looks like that's how I'm doing it, that explains it for you. The second thing I want to ask you about is the handouts. I don't know how useful the handouts are. You know how dependent I have become on PowerPoint. And I really like using PowerPoint, and providing you with handouts is may be helpful, it may not be helpful. What I've done and what I've done in the past is just simply reproduce the slides I give you on the screen. There is also a format that PowerPoint will allow to just do the notes, not the pictures, not the graphics, but just the notes. But the problem with that is there's no way to adjust the font on those, as far as I know. And it's not very big. And so there's plenty of room to write your own notes on those kinds of pages. But if you tend to squint, then you probably wouldn't like that format. Is there any suggestion to me or any input that you would have in terms of what you want from me regarding this kind of thing? You know, I've done what I've done in the past, and so, you know, yeah.
I very much like the handouts, yeah. Even as you have them up there, because you can say something here, and we can see.
You know where I am.
Right, and we can make notes on here. Yeah.
Okay, that was a vote in favor. Any violent opposition? We'll pretend we're in Presbytery here. You know. Okay, all right. Well, I will do that. Now, as I do that, one other caveat here is I tend to reproduce them, your handouts, in the color form if it makes a difference. But there's pressure from the front office these days to ixnay the ullerkay. And so I may reduce it to just black and white if possible. And I probably, yeah, that's color.
Maps are good in color.
Maps are good in color. I know, that's my problem. And so what I've done is I've taken out a lot of maps that I'm going to be using. You don't have the handouts, all the maps I'm going to be using. But you probably don't need those anyway. They're just for illustration and just for reference. And you can always pull down a map from Google and look at it yourself if you wanted to. The third thing I want to say in introduction to the course is that I'm going to be doing it in chronological form. If you're using my Old Testament reading schedule this year, you'll know that that I always like to, especially as we integrate the prophets and the wisdom literature, I like to structure the reading chronologically because I find that that helps you to have the context and the background for the prophets particularly. Sometimes, you know, we read through the prophets and go, what is he talking about? Why is he so angry? And having the chronological background, having the historical background helps you to grasp what the prophets are barking about. And I'm going to do the same with the New Testament survey. I'm going to start with the incidences, and then from there move toward the history as we find it in the book of Acts, because I have to use that as a backbone, even though the book of Acts is written later, and integrate a cursory examination of Paul's letters as they come along chronologically. And so that explains that. And it also, and my vision, at least to start with, is to say that we won't actually get to the study of the Gospels right away because they were written probably some of the latest pieces of literature that go in the New Testament canon. The first were the letters of Paul. And so I want you to know that it kind of explains that. So when we come up to the time of Christ, I'm not going to be talking about the Gospels. In fact, we're going to go through the time of Christ very briefly with my vision to return to them in depth at some later point. Probably not in this course. Any questions or comments about that? Okay. Well, where I want to start with, after emphasizing chronology, what I want to start with the New Testament is the end of the exile of Israel. As you know, the Bible is about one message. It's about one person. It's about one mission and goal of the Father to redeem His people through the blood of His Son, to bring about the bride of Christ. That's what the whole Bible is about. And as one pastor I remember saying, open your Bibles to the end of Malachi and the beginning of Matthew, and you see that page that's in the middle that says the New Testament, I want you to tear that out of your Bible. Because he is emphasizing the fact that there is no formal division between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It is one flowing work of God in all of history. And as long as you understand that, you understand a lot of what's going on in the Old Testament. But if you don't understand that, if you think there is this strong division, if you think there is this separation even of peoples, or even the way that God treats people, these are by law, this is by grace. No, as long as you understand that kind of separation, you don't understand the Scriptures. And the work of God from beginning to end to glorify Himself in the blood of His own Son to bring about the bride of Christ. That is the goal of all of history, and that is the goal of God in bringing everything to pass. And so we want to knit the old and the new together by starting with the end of the exile and move forward from there. That also will give us a little bit of the context in which the Gospels present themselves. You might be aware, if you've read Old Testament history, if you've studied Old Testament history, you come up with Daniel, for instance, and he's caught up in the third attack of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, and he's hauled off to Babylon, where he lives out the rest of his entire life, anticipating and longing and hoping for the return of his people Israel to their homeland. And then you start in Matthew, and it's talking about Rome. It's talking about Judea, and you're going, why is there such a dramatic difference between the two? And what's going on in that period. That theologians, historians used like to call that the 400 silent years. That's not really the case. God is working very powerfully during this period of time. But it's called the 400 silent years because with the ceasing of revelation in the book of Malachi, there isn't any further voice from God to the people until the coming of his son. It's like the quiet of the midnight before the dawn. But that period of time means a great deal for us to understand, because so much of the pieces are moving around, and we want to stay on top of that, or at least be aware of that. I didn't pay Paul to do this, but if you were here last Lord's Day, Paul Foster in his sermon basically taught my lesson in summarizing that 400 silent years. So I'm going to be doing the same thing he did with nice maps and graphs and pictures. Maybe you'll think more of my survey than him. But anyway. Yes, okay. So let's focus on where we leave off with the Old Testament. As I said, King Nebuchadnezzar is actually King Nebuchadnezzar II. He's the king of Babylon. He's, I think, the fourth or fifth king in a row of this kingdom, and he is in his capital city is Babylon. And because there is so much glory and so much power and so much wealth built up in the kingdom of Babylon now, or Babylonia, that he puts a lot of endeavor, probably more than anybody so far in history, in glorifying his capital, his nation, by building up his capital city. And we're familiar with some of the references to the city of Babylon, how glorious it is, the towers, all of the beauty of the walls are symmetrical. There's even the front gates, which are a stunning blue color, have been recovered archaeologically and are now in the British Museum, in standing as tall as the ceiling is here, in all of its glory, with the lions and everything else. I should have brought a picture of that. But there was so much beauty and wonder and power that is demonstrated in the work of Nebuchadnezzar particularly, that it really makes you understand why, as Daniel says, Nebuchadnezzar stepped back and he said, look at my city, look at my, no one else has topped this, no one else has beaten this, you know, and I built this all myself. You know, it just lends itself to the pride and the vanity of such a ruler as that. But Nebuchadnezzar falls by the power of God. That's the first sign of the providence of God, not just for Nebuchadnezzar, but for all of his work, all of his design is not to just let Nebuchadnezzar sit and rejoice in his own power and chutzpah, but to bring him low on purpose and deliberately and very personally, to confess the Lord God is over all. And that change, like I said, was not just a conversion of him spiritually, but it was a pronouncement to all the world who it is that is indeed the glorifying one of all mankind. Babylonia it takes its place in a list or a line of four major kingdoms that rise and fall in the what becomes the area of Asia Minor. Asia Minor is a very rich area and a very influential area for these ancient kingdoms, and Babylonia takes its turn in the unfolding of this. First, There's the ancient Hittites. We used to joke about Hittites because they didn't exist anymore and it was safe to pick on them. The ancient Hittites were the very first ones to occupy the area with power. And after the Hittites came the Assyrians. And you can see that their kingdom was bigger. Hittites was, okay, you know, not bad size. Hittites were bigger. The Assyrians were bigger. And you notice that they found the power and control of the rivers to be to their influence. And they also went down and occupied Egypt and the Nile. The coastline of the Mediterranean, the waterways of the Nile, the Tigris and Euphrates, they see the discovery of these things as powerful and influential and helpful to their kingdoms. And so the kingdoms get bigger and bigger. The capital of the Assyrian Empire is Nineveh. And it is during the powerful reign of the Assyrians that the 10 tribes of Israel fall. You remember that they separate off from Judah and Benjamin in the south. And the Assyrians come in and conquer the 10 tribes to the north. Eventually the Assyrians are even taken over by the Babylonians. And even though this is a different map, you can take note of the fact that it's even bigger. It's an even bigger area. They're conquering more and more territory. And because the expansion is now all there is to the ancient empires. And the more you have, the more control you have, the better off you are. Babylonia down here is the capital city, and they occupy and control what's referred to historically as fertile crescent, the rich green area that is fed by these rivers. And the communication lines go through there as opposed to the mountainous and the desert regions that go between them. And so this area is very prime. And you notice that the Babylonians were not so concerned with south, but they did go down to control the traffic area that went up north and south from Egypt. And it's from the Babylonians that Judah and Benjamin fall. They conquer Judah eventually and carry off Daniel and the others, as I said, and this is the powerful nation that is there at the close of that period of Old Testament history. But after the Babylonians come the Persians, Cyrus the Great, which we read of in Daniel as well. And the Persian Empire, you can see, doesn't know where to stop. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the more land you have, the less enemies you have to worry about. And the more communication and the more travel and the more trade you can get involved with and the more peace you have. And so the nations are just getting bigger and bigger. But the problem is, the more land you have, the harder time you have governing them. How do you govern so much growth in property and so much growth in different people groups? How do you handle this? The first three, or I'll pick out three of these empires, they treated their enemies all differently. They treated the nations on their borders differently according to the working philosophy of the time. The Assyrians, for instance, you remember one of the early ones, right after the Hittites, their approach to commanding peace on their borders was to eradicate all of those other cultures, to wipe out all of those neighboring nations. And so, when we read of the Assyrians conquering the 10 tribes of Israel, what do you know from the New Testament? That they carried off half the people. They just marched right into the tribes of Israel, said, pack your bags, half of you are going north. And they would disperse them. They would scatter them throughout the rest of the empire. And then they would bring in people from all of those empires and they would bring them over and put in mixed people groups. So you not only had mixed languages, you had mixed cultures, you had mixed laws, and you had mixed religion. And so with that, you had the influence of the Israelites, who were trying to maintain some credibility and some influence in their history, but you had others that were coming in and mixing in with pagan ideas and stuff. And the result of that was, it was by the time of the New Testament, the mixed people group called the Samaritans. And the Samaritans, by the time of Jesus, were in competition with the Jews, which was just the nickname that the 12th tribe, the Judites, took on after they returned. So you had the Samaritans in competition with the Jews, and you know the Samaritans were up north, and they said, well, the Bible, you know, the Torah says that the holy mountain of God is in one place. We're gonna move it, change the Old Testament, the Torah, to say Mount Gilboa, which is up in our area, and they made several adjustments like that so that you would claim that they had the authentic Old Testament Torah and compete with the southern Israelites in saying, we're God's people and you aren't. And so they, rather than trying to come to some kind of agreement, or they saw them in competition. And that's why we read in the Gospels, you know, that the hostility between the Israelites and the Jews and the Samaritans, that they mixed all the mixed people groups, the cultures, the languages, everything else, was an abhorrence to the Jews in the south. And Jesus spoke demonstrably about how that competition was inappropriate. But that's how Assyria treated their enemies. They just scattered them. They just obliterated them. When Babylonia came along, their expanded borders meant, well, let's try something different. That was a lot of work to import and export people, and we're going to centralize our government and strengthen it. So, in other words, we're going to bring in all of the excellent potential that all of these other groups and nations have, and we're going to bring them into Babylon, and we're going to strengthen ourselves from within the center. That's why they were interested in Daniel and his friends. Daniel showed a lot of potential, showed a lot of acumen. He was a bright kid, and he said, we're gonna take the best and the brightest from all of the nations, and we're gonna bring them to Babylon, and we're gonna strengthen our own nation from within that way, and leave them with the weaker ones on the side. We'll tell them what to do, but we'll basically just leave them alone. So we see that pattern going on, and then when the Persians come along, their landmass is so big, that's not going to work for them. So what are they, instead of centralizing, they're going to decentralize. And so they wind up sending the Israelites back home. They, you know, you're our satellite people now, and we want you to be strengthened on our borders and fight for us. You know, if the Egyptians come rattling up from the south, we want you to fight for us. And so we want you to be strong, and we want you to be able but of course you're our vassal, and you're going to pay taxes to us. And that's how the Persian Empire decided it was going to control things. So when we read about Cyrus the Great coming along and saying, okay, you after 70 years of exile, where we have now had to have you guys in our midst and you know, feed and clothe you and all this stuff, we're going to send you back. And so providentially, in the hand of God, that's exactly what happened. You know, the Israelites packed up and were able to move back home, because that was the idea of the Persian Empire, was to strengthen its borders and let them do the fighting for them. The option was to return home if you wished. In other words, they were very, you can even read the letter of Cyrus making this announcement. It's very gracious. You wonder, why is the king of all the world being so very gracious to these nobodies and inviting them to go home, as opposed to saying, get out of here, you know? And the reason for that is that he knows that many of the Jews who were now spending generations in Babylon had become comfortable, had become settled, were not interested in going back. And when so he said, I'm going to invite you to go back if you wish, because what would he get if he did that? He'd get the most earnest, the most committed, the most willing to sacrifice, the most diehard, committed people to their own religion and culture. They would be the ones to go back. And they would be, of course, the ones who would do the best job of fighting for him. And he gave them permission to rebuild their temple. He wanted them strong. He wanted their culture strong. He wanted everything to be as equipped as possible, because they're going to defend his border, and that's great. So he said, go back and build your temple again, and start all that up, and reoccupy the city of Jerusalem, and here you can even take your gold and your silver back. I'm going to equip you with it so that you can you'll be able to handle it, and everything will be fine. You go back, and so there were three endeavors to do that. Before I get to that, you know, when this dropped into their laps after 70 years of occupation, the prophets that we read during the time of the exile are ones that are trying to tell the people to hang on to hope, because the exile was traumatic. To be pulled out of your homes and to be hauled off and to be told that you're now the house and the city and the temple that you left behind is now all burnt to the ground. Where is the hope of our God? And it was during the exile that the history we know today as 1st and 2nd Kings was written. And it's called 1st and 2nd Kings because that's just a pragmatic division in our translation efforts. The role of the kings, the scroll of the kings, is huge. And in order to make it usable, we just simply divided it into two. So there you have 1st Kings, 2nd Kings. That's where that comes from. But the original scroll told the whole story as if it was one simple account from beginning to end, and it went through the kings and the episodes with David and Solomon and the united monarchy and the divided monarchy and then the fall. And so it painted the whole picture. But because they were in exile and because the writer of 1st and 2nd Kings was recording it then, he was also trying to answer questions for his people. He was trying to reassure them. He was trying to encourage them, because he knew what everybody was asking was, how could God let this happen? You know, you read the Psalms by the river of Babylon. You know, we sat down and wept. And, you know, our conquerors said, sing us a song, entertain us, you know, and how can we do that? They were so discouraged. They were so brought down. And said, how could the God of all creation, of all redemption, how could God allow this to happen? And so you read 1st and 2nd Kings, and you know what you find? You find more than anything else, the sins of the kings is demonstrated very clearly. The story of David and Bathsheba, for instance, is colorfully described. The sins of the kings, the falls, the rising up of the idolatrous practices, because the answer is coming across, you did this. You let God down. This is God's punishment to you. And the writer's trying to push them to repentance. To repentance and to crying out to the Lord for forgiveness. And so when the return was announced, and Cyrus is saying, go back if you want to, that is the period and the time that 1st and 2nd Chronicles was written. Now, 1 Second Chronicles, as you know, it repeats a lot of the same territory, a lot of the same historical rendition. It starts and stops in a different place. But when you read Chronicles with awareness, you understand he's answering a different question. He's answering a different question. The question that they're now asking is, does God still care? Does God still want us? And he's trying to charge the people with a vision again. You've repented before God, you've asked for the Lord's forgiveness, and now I'm charging you. Go back, start over. Go back, rebuild. Go back and inhabit the land. And I gave you a breakdown of the parallels between Samuel Kings and Chronicles. And you notice that Chronicles starts with David as king. But David's kingdom, his reign, is in a much more favorable light than that of Samuel Kings. And Chronicles also starts off with 9 whole chapters of genealogy. My Old Testament professor used to say that's God's solution to insomnia. Read the 9 chapters of First Chronicles. 9 whole chapters of this guy. You think Matthew starts off slow. 9 chapters of this. Why does he do that? Because he is positively, encouragingly, hopingly connecting you as an exile to your roots. God has not forgotten you. God will prevail, and he will see you through. That's the vision. That's the difference. That's the hope that's being cast, the vision that's being cast in Chronicles that is different than that in Samuel and Kings. So just as God's providence would have it, just as with the Babylonian exile, which took place in 3 phases, there was a first carrying off, there was a second carrying off, and then there was a third carrying off, and the third one was when the temple was destroyed and burned off. There were also 3 phases of return. There were 3 times in which the people of God led themselves off. First was the small band of the most courageous. They were facing the frontier, the rubble, the enemies, the fear, the anxiety, the what ifs. And after they made their way and were the first ones to land on the scene, word would get back saying, and it would inspire the second group, and the second group left, and then a third group left. And the first group took a more indirect route through Rezif and Aleppo and down past Samaria and into Jerusalem. But the trips of Ezra first and then Nehemiah took a southern route, more direct, more speedy. Let's get there. And of course, then you read of the establishing of God's people in Jerusalem. They took the rise and they see the temple in absolute ruin. Jerusalem is burnt to the ground. There is nothing. And they start from scratch. But then with Ezra and Nehemiah, more and more help come, more and more strength come, and they begin to rebuild. The temple that they build is not going to be anywhere near as glorious as the one that was first destroyed. And you remember that the people groups to the north that will be called Samaritans, see if I have a map of that. Oh yeah, there's the 3 phasings. The people groups to the north didn't want the Jews coming back and began to hassle them and attack them from the north. And that's where the very classic description of the Jews building the temple with one hand a trowel and the other hand a spear to defend themselves as they reconstructed the walls of Jerusalem and they reconstructed the temple and they rebuilt their homes. And all of that you read of. And so there, the 3 phases of the return took place. And with the conclusion of the work, you have the reading of the law and the reconstituting of the covenant. We are God's people. and how powerfully that was laid out and dramatically in recorded for us in the prophets. This is a general map of the area at the time. You had the region here that would be known as the region of the Jews or Judah. And then you had the Edomites to the south. They are relatives way back, but basically just jealous for their own land. You had the occupants of Ashdod along the coast, and you had Samaritans in the north. And so the Jews then, just as the Jews do today, have a definite reason to protect their territory. And they had to appeal to Cyrus in order to make sure that he would have their back. Remember, he says, "I want you to be strong. I want you to build your temple because you're going to defend my border." And the others get in the neighbor and say, "Not so fast. We don't want you here." And so he would say, "What do you say, King?" And King says, "Yes." And so they were allowed to progress and to finish. But things are not the same. And this is the part that is very clear to the Jews when they return. Things are just not the same. The exile did two things. The exile was a removal of God's covenant favor in two ways. First of all, God took away their land. The land was one of the most powerful symbols of God's grace. And when God removed them from the land, that was the worst part about the judgment of God upon them. But when they came back, they had to realize the land did not belong to them. The land belonged to somebody else. The land was part of Babylon. They would never occupy their own land again because of the way that God had punished them in the exile. And also, of course, they were not their own people. They were not governing themselves as they had before. They were no longer a kingdom. They were governed by other people. They were allowed to be in their homes. They were allowed to do what God wanted them to do, but they belonged to some, the land belonged to somebody else, and they were governed by somebody else. And so they're very uncomfortable with this fact that it's just not the same. The consequences of sin, national sin, radiated over even to the recovery. They're not a theocracy anymore. A theocracy is just a big word that means God governed. God is the one who charges us. God is our king. It's the way it was supposed to be originally, and it hadn't been that way ever since Saul. And now it's become very true and very clear to them. We're not governing ourselves. It's not a theocracy anymore. They are not led by the Lord. Remember, this is the beginning of the 400 silent years. God's not speaking. After Ezra, after preaching, after laying down the law and the covenant, God doesn't say anything to them. Where is God? Where is God in all this? God remains quiet as prophets are not speaking. And they don't know what to make of that. Are we doing the right thing or are we not? Even the ones who were sincere and devoted had to ask that question. They just didn't know. The temple was not the focus anymore. The temple, you know, even when they first got there, you naturally think, okay, the first thing I need to build is my own home. I need to put my family someplace. I need to put a wall around my sheep or something. And then, of course, the next thing was defense against these ornery neighbors. And it took a reminder. You need to go back and build the temple. That's what you're there for, to build the temple. So they finally got around to building the temple. But the temple is not the focus anymore, and that's because for 70 years now, there was no temple. And so even the hard, committed Israelites who said, we're going to continue worshiping, reading the Word of God, singing to God, worshiping God, that was the time when the synagogue rose up. The synagogue was not the temple. The synagogue was just a local gathering place where the men of Judea could gather together and read the scriptures and pray and sing, and be encouraged in their faith. And they would go home and strengthen their families. And they would raise up their boys, and they would bring them to the temple, and I mean to the synagogue. And at 12 years old, they would go through their bar mitzvah. They would read the scriptures, and they would and be pronounced, "You are now a man." Circumcision wasn't given to them when in adulthood. It was given as a sign of the covenant when they were born. But when you could stand before the men of the synagogue and read the scriptures yourself, you were a man. And that was the rite of passage. And that became the strongest tradition of the exile. And it eventually carried over. Now the synagogues were what they were used to. Now we're a little more spread out. We have the land to occupy. The temple is in Jerusalem. But we get our synagogues. And our synagogues are the smaller groups. And we would gather together for, that's where the worship of God would take place. That's where the teaching of God, the regular meeting of God with God on the Sabbath day became the gathering of the synagogue worship. And it became the focus of Jewish life ever since. Now, you know, wherever the Jews are scattered to, they have their synagogues. And with the synagogue, you have your rabbi. Now, a rabbi is not a priest. Some rabbis could be priests, but the rabbi was the educated one, the one who could read the scriptures. Even by this time, reading Hebrew was beginning to fall out of favor, and not too many could actually read the Bible, the Old Testament, anymore. By the time of Christ, the bar mitzvah, you know, would come along, and the boy would come up, and he would have those two lines memorized. So he wouldn't have to read. But, you know, the Hebrew language is starting to fade because of the cultural influences and because of the influence of other people groups. The Hebrew is starting to, now it's being replaced by street languages and the languages of the cultures that they're a part of. And so to focus on Hebrew was a determined effort on the part of the rabbis. But it was now the real focus of them. And to support the rabbi, they would say, we need at least 10 people groups. We need at least 10 families. Why 10 families? Why do you think you need at least 10 families to have a synagogue?
To be supported by the tithe.
Because your tithe would support the rabbi. And 10 tithes make a whole, right? So you needed at least 10 families to start a synagogue, and that became much more prominent and much more dominant throughout the region. But it's called the 400 silent years, in ignorance by some people, thinking that nothing's going on. That's kind of a parenthesis, a kind of a gap. The world's just running at idle until something changes, when actually there are momentous changes that are going on, not only within the Jews, not only within Judah, but all around the world. Things are changing, and things are changing for a purpose that we don't discover until the time of Christ. But the 400 following years are very important. In fact, it lasts longer than the kingdom of Judah did, that you read about in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. This is a longer period of time than we read of in the history of the Old Testament. And it changes the entire stage for the coming of the gospel. There's two trends that are happening here. The world is quickly changing. Things are changing at the speed of light. And if you're not reading the newspaper, you don't know who's in charge anymore. And it's becoming very quick. And at the same time, the Jews who return, remember, are among the most determined, the most committed to plant the flag and to have their culture and to hold up the Torah and to protect their identity going forward. And they would become entrenched. You know, now you've got, you know, The dads would come to the synagogue on Sabbath, and they would say, "What am I going to do with my 13-year-old son? He wants to get an iPhone. He wants to be on social media. All his friends like to hang out on Friday night. The world is challenging us, and the world, you know, we gave into the world before, and you know, look where it got us. Look what happened to us. And it was saying, we're going to stop this. And so they built trenches, or you know, theoretical trenches around their homes. You cannot relate to other people. You cannot be influenced by anybody else. You are a Jew. You have to stay a Jew. And their regard for the law became the same. They became stubborn. We sinned against God. That's what Samuel Kings told us. We sinned against God before he carried us off into exile. Look at what happened. We're not going to do that again. And so their effort to trench themselves took place in regard to the view of their theology. They said, okay, we look at the law and we see the commandments of God. But there are questions that come up regarding the law of God. Do not take the name of the Lord in vain. What does that really mean? How do you know if you're taking it in vain or not? We have to be sure we're not taking the name of the Lord in vain. So we'll build a fence around that commandment. So that we do not take the name of the Lord in vain, we won't take the name of the Lord, period. No one's allowed to say the name of the Lord. That way we're safe. Remember the Sabbath day. Well, what constitutes a day? Is it, you know, they didn't have calendar time watches like we do. We say 24-hour today, but is it sun up to sundown? Genesis says sundown to sun up. What constitutes a day? Do not work on the Sabbath day. What constitutes work? And so they began to have more and more fences around the fourth commandment, to the point where they would say, your wife drags a chair upon the, along the dirt floor of your house in order to put it before the table. She might be plowing. There's a rut. Can't do that. That's work. How far can you travel on the Sabbath day? And so they had to measure that specifically. And so you had fences built around the law of God to keep people in line and to keep the hope of God alive. The ones who were the most committed to this actually took their cue from Ezra, who, remember, stood before the people and read the law, and they said, we will do this. This is what, we will obey this. And he was one of the most sincere and devoted of teachers of the Jews. But those who followed him kind of took their cue from him, added fences to the law, and they became known as Pharisees. That's where the Pharisees come from. The Pharisees are the ones who said, we're going to protect the people by putting fences around the law so that they stay within the bounds, so that they keep their identity, so that we don't sin against God. The Persian Empire had begun in 539 BC by conquering Babylon. They were the latest and the greatest. They had the most territory, you remember. They had their philosophy about how to protect their borders. They made one mistake, historically speaking. Pushing west was not a problem. India, not a problem. South, not a problem. North, not a problem. But they pushed west. And in the west, they came across the little bitty kingdom of Macedonia. And when they came and pushed onto Macedonia, Macedonia pushed back in a way that was most providential and dramatic. Here's the conquest of Cyrus the Great spread all over the map here. You see, they get to the west, they get to the area of Macedonia, and that's when the king's son, who happens to be named Alexander, decided to push back. Alexander was a young man in his 20s. How much field command experience, how much wisdom in battle, in coordination, in supplying his men, how much could he possibly have known at such a young age? You know, he comes home from college and says, oh, I'll fight him. It's only providential that God gave Alexander the imagination and the creativity not to fight within the box as so many other armies were doing. Every time he fought against an enemy, he had the vision to look at them and say, well, what are their weaknesses? How could we benefit from that? And so every battle was different. Every battle was fought differently. Sometimes he would advance, sometimes he would pretend to retreat. He was the most imaginative and creative general that had ever been known. And within just a few years, I don't think even 10 years, no, less than that, his empire was the biggest the world had ever seen. Pushed all the way into India, all the way south to the bottom of the Nile, all the way through up through Thrace in Greece. The world belonged to Alexander. And with Alexander came the dominance not only of his control, but also of his culture and his language. All of that would change the entire known world going forward. Now, just as providentially, upon his return, he stopped advancing east because of only one reason. His soldiers said, we're tired. We're tired of winning. Boy, does that sound familiar? We're tired of winning. We want to go home. And so he said, okay, all right. And as they returned home, they got most of the way home. And the story is different depending on who you read. Some people say he caught a bug. Others say he drank too much one night. Whatever it was, at 32 years old, Alexander dies. And immediately the world is thrown into chaos. And as he lay on his deathbed, the tradition goes, his generals said, who's to follow you, Alexander? Who's to follow you? Who's going to take charge of this immense empire once you're gone? And his classic line, and I believe it's true. Alexander said, it goes to the greatest. Okay. It goes to the greatest. Fight it out. That was his attitude. And so we're going to end there. At the death of Alexander, and the world is now Greek, and we'll pick it up then, because we want to know, the next thing we want to know is not only the Greek background, but the Roman background and the background of the neighbors, and how all of those converge and play a role.